Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste.
Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome to another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. Joining me is Paul Williams. How are you, Paul?
Yeah, I'm all right, Matthew. I'm all right.
Has it been hot and sweaty at work today?
I haven't been at work today. I was in, on at the start of 2 weeks off, so Joe and I popped off to Bath for the weekend to celebrate 15 years together. But we didn't actually do very much. We had a little wander around. We went to HMV and I bought a couple of records, which was a bit... It's my birthday on Friday. I probably should have waited. But
well, happy birthday for Friday.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, we came back lunchtime.
Fair enough.
Not quite as warm over there as it is here. It's
well, particularly over the weekend when it was pissing it down everywhere on the Saturday.
Yeah,
or certainly on the Friday rather, on the Saturday morning. But Bath's very nice, very picturesque. I recommend it to anyone wishing to do a little bit of tourism at home from the UK. Nice Roman baths, slightly weird race course, lots of good eateries. There we go. That's the tourist bit done. However, this is an Arsenal podcast, so we should probably talk about that before we lose all the listeners that haven't already left in the first 3 minutes. Football has started again, rather than just kind of frustration from fans wanting things to happen. Looking where to start, I guess we'll start with the games first. Obviously, the timings of the games were not very conducive to everyone watching all of them. But we had the first one, didn't we, against the Colorado Rapids, which seems to be as part of the Kroenke ownership deal thing. I suppose if we were going to be in the States, we kind of had to play against Kroenke's American team. A game that was notable mostly because it was full of kiddywinks, all the youth players playing, and most of the first teamers only coming off the bench very late. Then perhaps more interestingly, we beat Bayern Munich 2-1, so perhaps the Gazidis power prediction is in full effect. And then, of course, we beat Fiorentina 3-0 just a couple of days ago. I know that you weren't able to stay up until the evil hours of the morning watching them, and frankly, I caught most of it after the event. Caught some of the Colorado game live and some of the Fiorentina game live, but strange enough,
to
Bayern Munich.
I'd forgotten about the Colorado game. That seems like that happened quite a while. When did that happen?
It was basically this time last week.
Oh, yeah.
Plus a few hours.
I've had a lot happen in the last week, so I'd sort of forgotten about that one.
Well, so have Arsenal.
So I have no idea. I know we won 3-0, but I don't know any more than that.
Well, goals from Bukayo Saka, James Olayinka, one of the youth players that hadn't really been that fancied, but is very popular around the club, who seems to be kicking on, and the new boy, Gabriel Martinelli, who scored from about 12 yards with his chest, which is something you don't see very often. From a left-wing cross by Dominic Thompson, he of the under-23s. But yeah, that game was a bit of a non-event, partly because Colorado had a game coming up shortly and therefore were playing mostly there. So it was kind of our third-choice team against their second-choice team. So
right.
The standard of defending on both sides was pretty, how can I say, unconvincing. But of course, Arsenal doing unconvincing defending is something we're all too familiar with, which was also the case against Bayern Munich. I guess you probably saw the goals from that one.
I saw Nketiah's winner.
Yeah, from some nice interplay from the other substitute striker, Tyrese John-Jules, who played a lovely silky one too with Callum Chambers, who was in the opposition box.
There was a really good touch at the start of that as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. It was an interesting game because for pre-season friendly, it was slightly higher intensity. I mean, I haven't seen the entire game, but I have seen sort of extended highlights and a bit of both halves in real time, and it seemed quite feisty, shall we say, with the first teams being quite equal, and then the kids doing it off the bench for Arsenal. Unsurprisingly, because it eyes us all. Munich's most dangerous player was probably Serge Gnabry.
I had no idea you were going to say those two words.
Yeah, exactly. Although honourable mention to Kingsley Coman as well, who basically is an absolutely terrifying winger because he does everything at incredible speed. And Ainsley Maitland-Niles was given a bit of the run around from him, but when he was starting to tie, you know, when you're not really a fullback and you're playing at fullback and you're starting to tie after about 50 minutes of a pre-season game, and then they bring on someone who runs as quick as any other bloody winger in the league, only can dribble with the ball as well. It's not ideal, but yeah. Anyway, we got a win against Bayern Munich, which is suitably entertaining.
Emery in,
exactly. What was notable about the game, I suppose, is that we saw Aubameyang playing on the right rather than up front with Lacazette up front in a sort of 4-2-3-1 Wenger style, with Ozil very much pushing on from attacking midfield and Mkhitaryan rather curiously and unconvincingly playing on the left. We've sort of seen a range of formations because in the Fiorentina game we started with the three centre halves before then moving into something sort of a semi 4-4-2-ish type thing as the game went on, with sort of people going for the 4-2-3-1. I mean, obviously, I'm assuming you've seen highlights of the Fiorentina game as well.
Yes. Yeah, well, the goals.
You saw the goals?
It's funny, actually, about a week ago, might even have been the Colorado game, there was like a highlights package on YouTube, and I started watching it, and it was literally like this player runs the ball out of play, and then it cuts to a throw-in being taken. And I watched it for about 30 seconds thinking, when is something going to happen? And nothing happened, so I sort of gave up. But yes, I have seen the goals from the Fiorentina game, Lacazette, a nice pick out for Nketiah.
And for Joe Willock as well. And for Joe Willock as well.
With his left foot, I noticed.
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly Nketiah is definitely putting his hand up to try and grab a spot in the first team squad on a permanent basis this pre-season. And Joe Willock seems to continue his progress, not just in terms of getting a goal or being a goal threat, but also, you know, so far this pre-season he's played a sort of a deep lying mid-central midfield. He's played a more advanced central midfield, and he's looked athletic and tidy and potentially dangerous in both positions, which is sort of, I suppose, nice to think that the impact he had in the Europa League final wasn't just because that game was dead. I mean, obviously, Fiorentina behind us in their pre-season preparations and, frankly, had an alarming second half of the season in Serie A to the point where they went from being challenging from Europe to being in relegation trouble towards the end of the season, despite the fact they've got a decent squad. But, you know, three pre-season wins from three, you can't really complain, particularly as the opponents haven't been, you know, just Boreham Wood-esque standard. And we march on with harder games on the horizon, obviously Real Madrid up next, which should be a suitable challenge, given that they have more than one player who has a very good record of tearing us a new one. And on top of that, Eden Hazard is obviously something we're all too familiar with, but also they've got a couple of Brazilian wonder kids in Vinicius Junior and Rodrigo, who scored a lovely free kick against Bayern Munich the other night, which is quite funny. Bayern Munich centre-half Nicolas Schüller, who Eddie Nketiah gave the runaround to when he came off the bench in a big way, dared the 18-year-old Rodrigo to have a shot from a free kick, and he just stuck it right in the top corner. And I'm one of those people that seeing Bayern Munich brought down a pick or two always gives me a disproportionate amount of pleasure. Obviously, the games are quite interesting because we've still seen Emery toying with different systems. I mean, reflecting back to last season and the shape of the squad as a whole, what would you have as your primary formation preference as things stand, do you think, given the personnel at our disposal?
I think I would like to see us with the four at the back. I think I probably said that last time I was on the podcast. I think we lose too much in midfield with the three at the back. But I'm imagining that the three at the back might be here to stay for a while until Bellerin's back and 100%. Although I guess a lot will depend on whether we actually manage to sign Kieran Tierney. Because I was chatting to a friend of mine who watches a fair bit of Celtic, and he seems to think that Tierney would be an amazing signing for Arsenal. So to get a player of amazing quality in, I think obviously that changes things.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no doubt that Tierney is slightly more defensively aware, shall we say, than Kolasinac, who is such a strange player, isn't he? Because he sort of, earlier in his career and internationally, has always played very defensive roles, you know, left-back, centre-half. He's built like a tank and should be a real defensive player, but he doesn't seem to have any consistency in his defensive performance at all. I mean, needless to say, we saw him involved in the first goal against Fiorentina at the weekend, and before being taken off for a change of shape. But Emery made some very interesting comments, actually, around that period, making it very clear that the alternation between formations was a product of our personnel, and that basically the playing the three at the back was to protect our less defensively sound fullbacks, shall we say, in Maitland-Niles and Kolasinac. It's sort of interesting hearing a manager speak so openly about, I mean, it's probably something that we've all recognised as fans watching the team, but certainly Wenger would have been a lot more oblique about discussing tactical deficiencies or players' weaknesses, I think.
Yeah. Yes, he would, absolutely. I think for me, it's, you know, we've talked a lot about Emery and his preferred formation. So, and his preferred formation for years has been 4-2-3-1. So it seems pretty obvious, particularly when you think about the midfielders that are at the club, that we would play that formation if Emery felt that we would be best served by it. And clearly he doesn't feel like that. And I think, you know, I'm a big fan of Ainsley Maitland-Niles, but he's not a right back. And on the left side of the pitch, Monreal's been a tremendous servant to Arsenal for years, but his legs seem to have gone. And Kolasinac is very good at running forward at pace, the defensive side of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other issue that Kolasinac brings is, you know, his running power, as you say, is a genuine strength, and it does obviously give us a tactical outlet, but also, because of his physical strength, he's quite hard to stop once he gets going. But as well as his lack of defensive awareness, his general ball retention isn't that great in terms of his sort of possession. He's not really a possession player. He's very good with his off-the-ball movement and is quite good with cutbacks and what have you in the final third. But in terms of actually just playing simple passing football in the middle third, he's got by far the worst passing stats of anyone in our defence or midfield. And it's not just because he's ambitious. He seems to have an inconsistency of technique when it comes to passing the ball as well. So even if Tierney might be slightly more conservative in some ways if he comes into the team, he is a genuine left back and plays like one in terms of his distribution, although he is better going forward than he is defensively, and as any YouTube highlights reel will show you, is a very good attacking fullback. And has been great for Celtic. Obviously, he's had some injuries in the last year and a half, so it's kind of waiting to see what happens with those. It's also kind of hard to see what's going to happen with that deal, because Celtic are desperately trying to, play Bertie Big Bollocks with it, aren't they? You know, Neil Lennon coming out and kind of trying to make a point of the fact that Arsenal don't have any money and that Celtic don't need to sell, and basically trying to act like Celtic are the big club in this scenario, which of course in Scotland
they are the big dogs.
But Scottish football, without wishing to offend anyone, is not of a very high standard, comparatively, and is not as financially powerful. I mean, the latest seems to be that Arsenal have put in another bid, but the add-ons Celtic do not deem to be realistic, or rather, because our add-ons are related to getting back into the Champions League, Celtic don't want to rely on that, which one can understand, and also it's another way of point scoring a little bit.
I'm like during the summer that even I've read that, and like you say, you can't really blame them. You know, we still probably think as Arsenal fans that there is a number at which point Celtic will say, yeah, okay, he can go. But perhaps that number isn't quite as low as we thought it was going to be.
Well, it's certainly not as low as was initially reported by the newspapers, particularly with Neil Lennon trying to say, look, Man United paid $50 million for Wan-Bissaka and Kieran Tinney's a better all-round player than he is.
Yeah, I thought that was quite an interesting comparison. He may well be a better player than Wan-Bissaka, but he's also playing in the Scottish Premier League for the last few years. So, you know, as we've just covered, the quality of that league's not particularly great. So,
well, also they're different players.
Is he a better player than Wan-Bissaka? Should he be going for $50 million?
Your face says a lot there, Paul. I mean,
yeah, but it's frustrating now, isn't it? It's the football clubs that they need to sell players. We need to sell players. We're probably the only club in Britain that needs to sell players to buy the players that we want to buy. And it's I try not to worry about things, and I'm getting off topic a little bit. Sitting in the middle of July talking about transfers that aren't going to, you know, the first team don't kick off in the Premier League for another month. It all seems a bit redundant to be worrying now. But when you just think about how Arsenal have gone from having more cash in them than the entire Premier League a few years ago to where we are now, and we're trying to sign this player and we can't because we can't offer Celtic enough money to get them to part with him. What's done is done. It's been and gone. But it's just absolutely maddening if you think about it too much, which is why I try not to think about it too much, and then I end up on podcasts.
Well, it is one of those things where, you know, Arsenal had a long-term plan, and then the world shifted violently around them. You know, the TV money is as such that everyone's got money now, particularly domestically, and obviously the oil barons and oligarchs and the Middle Eastern states have inflated the transfer market beyond all recognition. To the point where, you know, we were laughing last week on the podcast, you know, $80 million for Harry Maguire, $45 million for Lewis Dunk. And you're seeing that replicated. I mean, personally, I think Celtic's strength in this position is that Tierney grew up a Celtic fan and therefore is not under any circumstances going to kick off to try and get out of the club, which is the normal. You know, the sense that a player really wants to leave is normally something that keeps the price down. But given Celtic's position in Scotland is so dominant, it's not as if they need the money to then reinvest anywhere else. Because as long you know, they've already bought another left back for not a lot of money. But even if he's not quite at the standard of Tierney, he'll still be probably one of the best left backs in the Scottish Premier Division.
Yeah.
Simply because Celtic got so much more money than any of their rivals domestically. So it's a bit like the Zaha thing, you know, where the players we've identified that we want to buy are not from clubs who really have a particularly large incentive to sell those players. because it's not like they need the money, and it's not like those players aren't of value to them. In a way, Tierney's going to be more likely to be attainable regardless of cost, simply because Celtic do have another left back and he isn't as integral to their success or survival or whatever the equivalence is as Zaha is of Palace. But yeah, I mean, you do sort of raise another issue which I wanted to move on to, so that's good, which is about the angst about transfers with, I mean, it's probably 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks to go now before the end of the transfer window, given that it's a bit earlier this year. I mean, did you see any of the "we care, do you" stuff that has been flying around?
Yeah, I did. I retweeted it initially. More, I think I'm going to get crucified for anyone listening to this. But
you don't know what I'm going to say yet, Paul. Don't worry.
Out of a sense of duty than any sort of expectation that things are going to change as a result of this. I mean, I think it, you know, obviously everyone that's got behind this wants Arsenal to change the way they do things. They want Arsenal to improve. But the level it got to over the weekend, where you've got people sitting there in their new kits filming videos of themselves saying, "I care, do you?" And it's, but when you're sitting there in a £65 new home shirt, you're sort of undercutting your message a little bit, I feel.
Well, I'm very much inclined to agree with you. I mean, I have the slightly controversial stance in that I didn't retweet it. Because although some of it I agree with, there's quite a lot of it I don't necessarily agree with and don't necessarily agree with the timing of. I mean, I can see why it was timed with the American tour, because obviously that gives you a sort of greater access to Cronkyville. In all fairness, Josh did give a response, which was a mixture between offended and reassuring and indignant and waffling, which is exactly what someone in his position you'd sort of expect, really. But for me, it's a tricky one because so much of the dissatisfaction which underpins, you know, what the Arsenal fan base is feeling and what's behind this movement is sort of long-term dissatisfaction. It's a sense of having been sold a lie about the stadium. It's a sense of the fact the team is comparatively getting worse against superiorly financed opponents. It's about the errors made in the recruitment and the sales of players. But actually, most of the things that it talks about that aren't just about spending more money and putting money into the club, for me, the new ownership, well, not the new ownership, but since it's come under the sole ownership of the Cronkies and since Wenger has left, they've sort of been taking steps in that direction. Yes, they haven't been as smooth or successful as we would like, but the club's operating structure has changed. We now... it was also, I think, for me, the fact that it came literally about 2 or 3 days after Edu was confirmed as our new director of football, which is exactly the kind of move which the statement was advocating in a lot of ways. And then also talking about atmosphere in the ground and the unity between fans and the ownership. While I agree that there is a massive PR failure, or has been a massive PR failure on the part of the owners in terms of not trying enough to engage with the fan base as a whole, despite occasional interaction with supporters groups, the atmosphere in the stadium isn't just down to the ownership. You know, at the end of the day, there is this fractious relationship between the club and the fans, which is largely built of the end of Wenger days. So I feel very torn about it. Yeah, we'd all like to see the club being more proactive and ambitious in the way that some of our rivals are, but it does strike me that they're actually at present trying to address a lot of the issues that we all feel they should be addressing.
Yeah, I think... I was just going to say, in terms of the atmosphere in the stadium... The stadium's never gonna be. It can't replicate what Highbury was to everyone. You know, we all know that's not gonna happen. But what Arsenal have done over the years, and they were able to do it off the back of the success that Arsene Wenger's teams had in the first 10 years of his reign, was push the prices up because the demand at Highbury was so great. And they've ended up in a situation where, you know, as someone who was a Red member for, well, up until last season when I got my Silver membership, so 2004 to 2018, to go and watch, if I wanted to go and watch Man United or Tottenham play at Arsenal, if you got a seat in the upper tier, you were paying between 80, 90 quid for the privilege of that. So if you're pushing prices in that direction and delivering a team that isn't quite competing, I think people are going to get angry and they're going to ultimately probably do what I did and choose to pretty much stop going. You know, I've got a Silver membership now. I don't know if I told you this, but I literally cancelled my direct debit last summer because I just thought, I can't be bothered with this anymore. What's the point in having this membership? And then literally 3 days or 4 days later, I got an email from Arsenal telling me, oh, congratulations, you're now a Silver member. I was like, shit, I better reinstate my direct debit. So I do think the owners definitely bear some responsibility for the way things are in the stadium. Yeah, and it is on the fans to create the atmosphere once they're in there. But the Emirates is, the demographic of the Emirates feels very different to how it was when I first started going to Highbury in the early 90s. It is different. You know, we're sort of moving into that demographic ourselves, I guess.
Well, age-wise, not financially, sadly.
But it is, you know, when you used to go to Highbury, and you know, everyone that ever went to that ground knows the North Bank made the noise, the Clock End made the noise, and if it was really exciting, I think Alan Davis said this on the 89, didn't he? Even the West Stand was singing it again.
Yeah, exactly.
But it now feels a bit like the Emirates is essentially, I don't know, 80% West Stand. And you've got a few guys in the North Bank lower that make some noise. And there's obviously pockets elsewhere. You know, for anyone that went to the Spurs game last season, the stadium was a bear pit. I wasn't there myself. My mate James was. He said it was the best day he's ever had at the Emirates. So, but that isn't the normal.
Yeah. It's that interesting thing. I mean, I agree that the ticket prices are obviously going to be a source of dissatisfaction. I mean, I suppose what's difficult is the club has raised its ticket prices. All the other clubs in London have then raised their prices to a similar or the same level, you know, at least at the top flight teams, while they've been achieving more success than they have historically for the most part, or been more competitive, whereas Arsenal have dropped off a tiny bit. And the difficulty, of course, comes from the fact that when the ticket prices were raised, ticket prices were a key element of financing the club and transfers and what have you, and so therefore more ticket prices had a direct correlation with more ability to buy players. Whereas now that has changed, so the ticket prices are sort of there to cover some of the operational costs. But if you actually break it down, the ticket prices don't even cover the wages of the players. Which is a very difficult thing, because yes, the club probably should be trying to be a bit more creative with its ticketing pricing, particularly providing more opportunities for young people. And I'd agree that is a very valid criticism to level at the club, because they're in danger of doing, which a lot of Premier League teams are in danger of doing, which is cutting off their future fan base at the knees, really.
Absolutely.
But short-termism is the name of the game in British football at the moment, for the most part. You look around at enough of the clubs and you see similar problems. But yeah, I mean, I've got no problem with that complaint, because it's one I think we can all identify with. And certainly if the prices were a bit more like they were when you and I started going, I mean, I think I started going even earlier than you. So then we'd be going a lot more than we currently do, because, you know,
yeah.
Because, you know, a bit like London house prices, ticket prices have risen at a rate far swifter than that of average earnings. But that's partly because, as you say, the demographics of people going to football have changed massively. I mean, you know, Jesus, when you and I started going, they were still marred with the kind of air of mass hooliganism. And so therefore, even when it's like £4 for kids and £10 to adults, you still couldn't sell all the tickets.
Yeah, well, it's not turning this into an old fogey thing, but my cousin Steve, who was a police officer, well, he still is a police officer at the time, he took me up to Highbury to get tickets for Arsenal Leeds. It was the FA Cup,
92-93. The many replays.
I don't know. I think it was just the one replay in the end. Right, he was suspended. He came back and scored 2 goals at Elland Road. But this game, we sort of came out of the tube station, it had sold out. So he was like, oh, fuck it, I'll just get tickets from the tower. And I was like, are you sure? And he was like, yeah. If they turn out to be moody, I'll just nick him. So we bought these 2 tickets for the clock end. And Steve paid £25 for the ticket.
Yeah.
Which is like, you imagine that now. But I think the main point about all of this for me is that football should be about going to football and having fun. And I don't feel, and this is another reason that I pretty much stopped playing, apart from the fact that the group of mates I used to go with dispersed massively.
Mm.
It really has stopped being fun going. I was talking to a mate about going to a game in the season, and he was like, well, you could just go to the pub. don't have to spend the money. I think that's the real shame of it. It's like Arsene Wenger created these teams that were, you know, amazing football teams, and they've given everyone bloody unrealistic expectations of what this football club is capable of achieving. But the main thing now is that, as someone said on Twitter at the weekend, it's like, oh, well, the football's shit now. And I said, well, the football's been shit for a few years. And you're having to pay through the arse to go and watch football that you're not really enjoying.
Well, I think you're right. It's also, you know, that it's sort of putting what you've said and what I've said together, it's that thing of, you know, you form those relationships with the club and with the fun of going. When you go when you're young and you go with some mates, and you maybe keep those mates and could keep going as a group, but it's one that the price means that young people can't go nearly as much as they used to, but also the way that the seating is allocated at the ground and the way that that transition was managed by the previous power mongers, shall we say, made it very hard for groups of mates to go together. Actually, it's very, very hard to get tickets as a group unless you're all buying season tickets at the same time, which, when you've got a 10-year bloody waiting list and everyone's got their own personal circumstances, is very, very difficult to achieve. So that makes it a lot harder for it to be a fun experience, because you're usually, if you go, stuck next to someone you don't know, which could be anything from, you know, someone who gets some tickets through work and isn't that interested, or it might be someone who's, you know, some of the really old school kind of racists that you still get knocking around in football grounds. And then, you know, you find yourself next to one of them and it just isn't very nice, frankly. So that's a big part of it as well. And that's something which I don't know how the club can address that, because, unfortunately, as I say, the way that transition was managed by the previous custodians, as everyone's calling themselves custodians now, just like the last lot, it sort of broke that up. And then the only way you can address that is to then get rid of people who have paid for the right to be where they are, so to speak. I remember us being unhappy at the time, but not really complaining en masse because the team was so incredibly successful. But now, as the team isn't so incredibly successful, we notice these things a lot more.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like things were all wine and roses back when we started going, really. I mean,
nope.
My first season at Arsenal saw the end of the North Bank and
the mural.
You know, well, yeah, not just that, but how they funded the you know, the rebuilding of the North, or the building of the North Bank stand, you know, the bond scheme. That,
yeah.
That caused no ends of angst.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, I mean, Jesus, quite often, apart from say 88 to 92, you know, that little period, most of the football around them was quite shit, frankly. I mean, you know, Leicester, they may not have the same character and fighting instinct and connection with the fans as players did in the old days, but the footballers now are technically a lot better than all except for the best, you know, footballers in good teams in those days. So that is something that we do have to remember. The fact is rather than just having the best players from within a 100-mile radius, teams are now made of the best players from around the world. And it's that global nature of it, which is also something which is hard to quite balance with the fan experience, because, of course, as you say, football clubs used to all be about going to support your local team, have that experience with like-minded people in a cathedral of sorts, whereas actually now, for better or worse, and in some ways it's definitely better, in other ways it's not as good, it's a global fan base. You know, as far as the club's concerned, you or I are of no more interest than, you know, some bloke in Singapore who will be lucky to ever get to come and see a game, should they wish to. Which is something, you know, as I say, it's a twofold thing. It is something to celebrate, because the idea of a global fan base and being able to be connected to that global fan base is something we never had before, you know, certainly pre the internet, but also pre, you know, British football, English football being the apex of fan interest globally. But at the same time, it does mean that the club are less interested in the match day fan, because frankly, they'd rather, it's less effort for them just to put some out for advertising and get loads of people around the world to buy some shirts and some memorabilia and maybe organise a big group trip to come to the stadium en masse for some League Cup game or something like that, so they can at least have that experience. And that's a reality which is not very fun to adjust to if you're of the former variety of ex-match-going fan who felt very much unified in a quite local sense to the club and its players. On the flip side of that, I suppose, to connect to that, just before we go back to the WeKDU stuff, did you see the clips of Hector Bellerin singing Arsenal songs in a pub in LA?
No, I've missed this.
Yeah, that was early last week. It was I think it was watching the Colorado game. He decided to drop in on an Arsenal pub where there's an LA Gooners meet on a regular basis to watch the game and watch the game with them. Had some photos with them. Was joining in the chants, and obviously it's only serving to solidify the legend of Bellerin, which is growing. I mean, it's interesting how he's gone from being someone that divided a bit of opinion and was getting stick when the team were getting stick to very much being a fan favourite for the most part, which I think is right, because I think he's an excellent footballer appears to be a very decent human being.
It was quite interesting on the Adidas video, because I don't think I haven't spoken to you since that dropped. Ian Wright spoke in his own voice. Everyone else was dubbed pretty much. And then you've got Bellerin at the end saying, "What can I say, man? This is home."
Yeah.
In that brilliant Spanish Cockney. I don't even know what you call that. Spockney. That's terrible abbreviation. He may yet go and break all hearts one day, but here is someone who gets what it means to play for Arsenal. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that would love to see him made club captain, if indeed Laurent Koscielny does depart N5 in the next few weeks, or even if Koscielny were to stay.
Well, I mean, we all know that we're gonna have the second year of the five captains, which sounds a bit like a chapter in a book about Roman history. And you know, once you look past Koscielny and Xhaka, there's not a lot of very obvious candidates to be other of the five captains. I mean, presumably Ozil will stay one of them, seeing as it seems that he's not going to be leaving and actually seems to be starting the season in better fitness and in better mental state than he did last season. But sure, Bellerin has got to be a candidate to be one of the five and long-term potentially club captain, assuming he can get back to his peak performance levels. But yeah, I mean, he is like the poster boy for international Arsenaldom now, isn't he? You know, he's the guy that grew up in Barcelona or near Barcelona, is probably a Barcelona fan, and has moved to London, has found his club, and has adopted everything connected to it, not just being a player, but you know, he sounds more London than half the fans. and I mean half the fans at the stadium, not just.
And he's cut his hair, thank God.
I would. I don't mind the long hair. Given his hair was still shorter than mine, I can't really criticise.
No. Yeah, I forgot who I was talking to there. Sorry.
It's all right. I can take a few angry tweets from a few people who get offended by men with long hair. I don't mind.
I'm not offended by his hair. I just, it was, or indeed men with long hair generally. But Bellerin's long hairdo was pretty special. And obviously, I don't mean special in a special sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's sad, isn't it? That you still get. I wasn't actually referring to you. I was generally referring to dickheads on Twitter because you did. Like, there was the photo.
Oh, do you get that?
Well, no, I don't, but because nobody knows who I am, so I'm unimportant enough to get any grief off anyone. the only time I ever really get any stick of anyone on Twitter is when I sort of venture into a conversation thread with some, like, you know, right wing nut jobs who are kind of.
Those people.
Yeah, yeah.
Tommy Robinson FC.
Oh, yes. Tommy Robinson, not his real name. Look up his real name, you twat. You might not know. But anyway.
I must remember that if I ever happen to be down Old Bailey with them all again. His name's Stephen, you cunt.
On a side motors, just.
I would never.
Just going off topic.
I won't.
Did you see the footage of the traffic warden? Who gave a ticket to the Tommy Robinson bus?
No, I heard about it. Yeah. I didn't see it. Worth looking at, is it?
It is worth looking at because it's not often you see someone so openly happy about in their job and then declaring their happiness. Well, he's getting abuse off, you know, these knuckle draggers. I mean, but going back to the kind of the broader points of the week, hey, do you? I suppose what I find interesting about it is how much it's been picked up by fans, particularly seen in America, you know, during some of the games, when some of the concerns could be seen as slightly more parochial concerns of the London fan base or the longer standing fans, which I find is very interesting because it means there is, you know, those fans from other parts of the world are still able to feel the same grievance about certain issues that don't necessarily affect them personally in the same way as they might affect the match day fan. Or, of course, it's possible that a lot of it is just about people wanting the club to spend more money in the transfer market and see that as our owner is super rich, why the fuck shouldn't you put some money in? Like other super rich owners have done.
I think it's a little bit unfair to say that Stan, you know, that we have spent money. You know, there's no argument that Arsenal have not spent money in the transfer market. It's just generally not been spent brilliantly, apart from Lacka and Orba, who, as my mate Luke would say, absolute no-brainers. After that, the £30 million signings we've made have not been good signings. And then when you factor in the fact that we've let players walk out of the club, good players walk out of the club on free transfers.
For peanuts,
it's just madness. I mean, why has that been allowed to happen? And maybe that's part of this, you know, would a more engaged donor have let those decisions being made. You know, we could have sold Alexis Sanchez for 60 million quid. We chose to swap him for Henrik Mkhitaryan. I mean, that looks mental in hindsight, although we have marginally got the better end of the deal. And I think the thing with this Kroenke thing, the fact that he didn't go to the Europa League final is something that even to me, he could, my rabble-rousing Gunnar days are over if they ever existed. Even to me, that just looks like, why would you not go to that match?
Well, I think it's also, what's interesting is, you know, a lot of people, I was going to ask you what you thought of the response from Josh Kroenke, Kroenke the second. Because ultimately, you know, a lot of people have been like, you know, as I say, it wasn't a good look that Stan wasn't at the Europa League final. And people have been talking about, you know, oh, he sent his son to give an interview, you know, he's hiding behind Josh. I think it's important to remember that actually, apart from with the LA Rams, which, you know, Stan's had to be heavily involved in because of the massively controversial things he's done with moving them from St. Louis, the rest of the sports teams they have, Josh is the front man. And I think because everyone's been so fixated on Silent Stan because he is the money and he is the boss, but technically him and his son are listed as partners in the company, and you know, as with some of the other sports teams, you know, Josh has been the one who spent time at the club. Josh has clearly been involved in the management changes. You know, he did, people were talking about it a bit like a work experience thing, but he did spend a period of time at Arsenal last season, and he's clearly, if anyone's going to be doing anything with Arsenal, it's clearly going to be him. You know, Stan's an old man who's only really interested in the Rams, really. So we should be, you know, yes, it's not a panacea or anything, but we should be pleased that Josh is engaged in some way, because ultimately going forward, he's going to be the one that either is or isn't engaged. You know, Stan's just the money.
Yeah.
I mean, continuing that, what did you make of the Josh Kroenke response, you know, interview stroke statement?
I've just got it in front of me now. I think the thing that struck me about it was when he said that we should be excited about what might happen in this transfer window. And there were shades to that of, or echoes of even Gazidis saying, oh, there are things we could do that would excite you before we sign Jovino, probably. So I think to have that echo is a little bit unfortunate. I think they seem to be pinning a bit of hope on Edu's arrival as the football director. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, looking at the, you know, the you should be excited. I mean, even though it's not the phrase I would have used, I'm glad he said it, because it sort of makes a rod for his own back, you know. So if nothing happens, that statement's going to bite him in the arse quite quickly. So he must be fairly confident, and he's not a stupid man, clearly, from the way he's
phrased
it.
That's true.
So he must be anticipating some kind of positive activity on the horizon. Otherwise, he wouldn't say that. He would just kind of avoid commenting specifically on transfers. First things first, you know, I think it is a good thing. And what for me turns the weak hair do you statement into a good thing, even though I have mixed feelings about the content and the timing, is that it did elicit a reaction from Josh Kroenke almost immediately as well. You know, it got picked up by the papers.
The next day, wasn't it?
It became a story, and as soon as it became a story, they arranged a video interview and a statement addressing it. Yes, it may not have been giving everyone the answers they wanted, and yes, he may not have addressed all of it. But, I mean, that did show I mean, let's not forget, bar Arsene Wenger, that's the greatest level of engagement we've had from anyone involved in running the club since David Dean was pretty much running the show before the stadium move. And even David Dean wouldn't come back that quickly. So I think we have to view that as a positive because, A, it means that fan action can have an impact of some description. At least it's noticed. And B, more importantly, you know, now Josh has a greater involvement in making decisions. He's more willing than his dad to actively communicate. I mean, we already know that he's been to some fan forum type thing, events and what have you, so he's not hiding away, but those haven't been publicised as openly as they otherwise might be. But clearly he's even more willing to play the game in terms of that than Gazid is, which is an interesting change, even though his role should be one step more removed. I mean, whether this is just a one-off or whether it becomes an ongoing level of engagement, it does mean that there has been, as I say, some sort of positive outcome. And I found his statement, though, woolly, as it by necessity has to be, I guess, I found it encouraging because it made you know that he has some involvement or investment in the structural change that are taking place and has some understanding of what the club is trying to achieve, which is the great thing that's been levelled at Stan, is that no one knows if he knows anything about football at all or not. Whereas even though Josh Kroenke was using quite general terms, he at least seemed to be talking about sport, competitive sport, in a way that sort of made sense, which is at least a tiptoe in a direction slightly more positive to what we had before. I mean, was there anything in it that, you know, having read it, that stands out for you?
But, you know, it's quite interesting where he says, we want to be clear, we're in sports for one reason and one reason only, to win. And I'm pretty sure Stan Kroenke said a few years ago that there's no point in trying to win trophies. I can't remember the exact quote, but it was like, I wouldn't invest in the sports thing to win trophies or something like that. I might be slightly misrepresenting him, but I think only slightly.
Yeah, you're not so far off. Yeah, I mean, certainly Stan's position was not putting good money after bad, shall we say.
Then, you know, maybe that's a few years of being involved with this football club, but you can't just treat it as a cash machine. If that realisation's happened, then obviously that's a good thing. But then if you think back to how long they've been involved and sort of the sense of drift that the club's been enveloped in for the last few years, that sort of makes more sense.
Well, I think there's also something to do with, I mean, even if you look at it in very cold economic terms, even as just an investment vehicle, Arsenal as a club, if it continues to stagnate, its value stagnates.
Yeah.
And frankly, as a football team, the only way you can increase in value is by achieving a certain level of success. Because now the football money's come in and there isn't that much more easy global, quick global market growth. Yes, there will be some, in particular in certain markets, but you know the massive leap forward in terms of financial power has partially happened. Yeah, there is more scope for it, but that's going to take unusual events or longer to be realised. Now, the quickest way to grow from this point is to have a degree of success. You know, we've seen the value of the other clubs in the Premier League who are competing with us increase. Yeah, okay, maybe Man City and Chelsea have spent more money than the comparative value increase of their clubs, but all the other teams around us that have seen significant increases in value have seen greater increases in achievement. Whereas Arsenal's commercial income has totally stagnated. It's one of the reasons why we're in a spot of bother at the moment. Another thing that Gazid has managed to not fucking do very well. And essentially the club has gone, the only club's value growth has only been due to the TV money and the global market growth. It has shrunk within its own market. And so even if you're taking a really cold-hearted view as an investment, that is not sustainable. So change was required. Also, I do think that because he's not been the one that's had to make all the money, Josh is probably slightly more amenable to, trying to make things happen in a more proactive sense rather than just looking at the bottom line, as we've seen with his involvement at the Colorado Avalanche in the NHL. You know, that's a sports franchise which is in incredibly good shape at the moment, and the basketball team they have there seems to be on the up as well. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's one of the great things that particularly annoyed me about the early part of the Kroenke regime and the latter part of the previous regime, you know, was that Arsenal could have invested from a position of strength and therefore actually accelerated their growth. But all parties, the old ownership and the new ownership combined, chose not to do that and chose to sit on their laurels thinking they'd already done the hard work. And therefore it became increasingly an exercise in getting Wenger to work miracles. And basically the entire model fell down when Wenger stopped being able to work miracles. and which is why we've seen the club essentially stagnate and go backwards over the last 4 or 5 years. It's because Wenger no longer had the competitive advantage in being able to hoover up young talent and squeeze blood out of a stone. And I think it took the owners and the managing director too long to see that change of the wind blowing, and that's a definite criticism that can be levelled at them. But change has come. Whether it's the right change, we don't know yet. The jury's very much sitting on the fence on that one.
Yeah. I think, you know, in the statement, he says, you know, we have made changes. This isn't the time for more change. I think that's probably right. You have to see what Rao, Vinay and Edu are going to come up with over the next year. We have to see what Unai is going to come up with over the next year. I know there are vast numbers of Arsenal fans that are very, very unconvinced by Unai Emery. I can understand that. I guess the nice thing for us at the end of this season, if it hasn't worked out with Emery, he'll be gone. We know that. So there isn't this danger of living the groundhog season that we had for the last 5-6 years of waiting for Wenger to fix up or get out.
Nice pause for effect, Paul.
yeah. I wanted to say the other thing. I thought it would be more poetic, but also obviously more profane. I guess having considered it, we just have to wait and see. And that sounds like a terrible thing to say after the last few years of, oh, well, maybe Wenger will turn it around. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. It is going to take time, you know. We're managing a Champions League wage bill on a Europa League budget. That sort of worries me because I think if we want to get better players in, how do we do that without shifting some of the players that are creating that wage bill? I think last time we spoke, I might have talked about, I thought there were probably as many as 10 players that four of them were going anyway. We knew that, or three of them, Cech, yeah, Ramsey and Welbeck.
Yeah.
But aside from that, there were 7 players that were pretty much deadwood. But hey, they're all still here, which is, it's going to be difficult. And, you know, maybe we're not going to make, I mean, if we couldn't make top four this season with so many things sort of fell our way, it does worry me about next season. Because as much as I think, well, all right, we were unlucky with Bellerin getting it. Bellerin, Welbeck and Holding all getting injured within weeks of each other and missing the rest of the season was you know, not something that could have been foreseen. But it doesn't mean something like that won't happen again next season. You know, Lacazette and Aubameyang got injured. I mean, please God, no. But if that were to happen, Arsenal have got a huge problem.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the one thing that, you know, relating back to the preseason friendlies and relating back to the pronouncements by both Raul Sanyehi and Josh Kroenke, which does give me the sense of optimism, which I sort of referred to at last week's podcast, is that last year we knew we had a good group of kids coming through, but we also knew that none of them were ready yet. Whereas this year, I think some of those problems with the squad, some of the inability to rotate players came from the fact that those players were not ready, and Emery was just trying to hook or by crook get us back into the Champions League. I think this season certainly will Nketiah's looks to have kicked on a bit physically and it looks hungry. I think Joe Willock, yes, okay, he's not going to replace Aaron Ramsey, but he does bring something that we need. Players like Bukayo Saka have shown that they're probably worthy of some games in the Europa League and in cup games, which will hopefully allow us to rotate. Maybe Emil Smith Rowe can get fit. Reece Nelson is back. I mean, we've still got massive issues when you go further back in the team, of course. You know, the closer to defence you get, the worse it looks. But I suppose one has to take into account what was said in the last couple of days, which is, given that long term, given that in the short term we're not going to be competing for a title, there's no point pretending otherwise. It's better to make what signings we make either very, very short term or with a real eye on the longer term, which I suppose is where the Saliba signing comes in. You know, we're buying a player that we know we're not going to have this season, but we also, it is generally regarded to have an extremely high ceiling in the long term. And I guess we have to cut our cloth accordingly. Of course, it'd be better if we can pick up one or two more bodies that can help in those positions, which are perhaps a little more temperamentally reliable than what we've got. But I guess the club now is slightly waiting to see what happens with the Koscielny situation before it can move forward, because the kind of player you bring in to augment numbers defensively, if Koscielny stays, it's got to be different to what you try and do if Koscielny goes.
Yeah.
Because Koscielny, you know, yes, was never going to play every game, but was, either first or first change centre-half. If he leaves, you can't just bring in someone to help make up the numbers who's either an ageing pro that you can put into small, lower profile games, or is a young player you're hoping can kick on. Maybe a left-footed centre-half to give us more balance. You know, if Koscielny goes, then suddenly that position becomes a far greater recruitment priority.
Yeah, can I just take a moment on Koscielny, actually? Because I felt terrible listening to Anita last week. Everything we've been through as a football club and as a fan base and having suffered with Anita through various transfer sagas, that Lauren Koscielny would be the man that makes Anita realise that getting names on the back of your shirt is a foolhardy enterprise. It's a sad day indeed.
Oh yeah. I mean, what's your take on it more broadly?
I think it's really disappointing. I mean, the guy has put his body on the line for Arsenal literally for what's felt like, was it the World Cup in 2014? We knew there was this chronic tendonitis issue in 2014, and we're here 5 years later. The guy's Achilles tendon snapped to pieces a year ago. He came back from that and played really well when he came back, and then his body started to give up on him a little. And on a human level, I sort of feel, what's one more player that we let go on a free transfer? But then the person that wants Arsenal to succeed and do well thinks, well, you know, he's the captain of Arsenal Football Club. To do what he's done, really, it's disgraceful, I think. And I think if I was Lauren Koscielny, I would I think the captain of Arsenal Football Club should realise that he does have a year on his contract. And even if Bordeaux were to, or Rennes, whoever, were to give Arsenal £5 million for him, why should that be a problem? I mean, it'll be a problem for him because it might impact on his wages, but he's been paid very well for the last 10 years. He's not going to starve. Bearing in mind the service he's given Arsenal, I think it's a real shame that it's come to this. You can only think something's happened in the background, some sort of misunderstanding. It wouldn't be the first time that it's happened with Arsenal and a player. But he's the captain of Arsenal.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes it so hard to take in a way. You know, if it was just an aging player who, you know, was looking after their legs and, you know, his personal circumstances, you can very much relate to it. But a club captain should still be a significant thing. And, you know, as has rightly been said, yes, he's thinking long term about his playing career and his financial well-being. But as, you know, no one needs telling, you know, he's still done very nicely financially out of this club. Not as well as, say, others who maybe at the club who are accountants might prefer to leave, but he's still done very nicely indeed. And the club has been very, very good for his career as well. And, you know, I suppose it shows one of the differences between him, who is a better defender, and a character like Mertesacker, who, although was not as talented, and even in his last season was saying, you know, I don't really want to play unless I have to, he sort of got the club in a slightly different way, it seems.
Yeah.
That's what this seems to suggest, is that, you know, Mertesacker took the role of being club captain really to heart, in a way that Koscielny has demonstrated it isn't as important to him as it was to, say, Per Mertesacker. And unless it's remarkably patched up in some way that's quite hard to see how it can be, that's going to affect his legacy. And I thought, it's an interesting thing, you know, do footballers, and which footballers, think about their legacy at a particular club? Yes, we know they think about legacy in terms of personal achievements or winning trophies, but do they think about how they're remembered at a club? You know, in years to come, will Van Persie, for instance, treasure his Premier League winners' trophy more than being, you know, revered at a club rather than being sort of rejected as a slight mercenary by everyone? It's an interesting thing, and I guess it's very hard to kind of form an opinion on him when you're in the midst of a situation about how important that is to you.
I can't remember where I read it a few weeks ago. He was saying that he was sorry he'd hurt some people, but he had to make the decision that was best for him. And, you know, again, you can sort of, on a human level, you can understand that he wanted to go and win the Premier League. It wasn't going to happen at Arsenal. But to go to Manchester United,
it's also the very worst thing about that situation, quite apart from forcing a move to Man United and writing a letter to the fans and all the rest of it. The very worst bit was that the players we bought, had he stayed, we would have been just as likely to win the title as United.
Yeah.
Because he left. He basically burnt all his bridges while we were in the process of signing the players that would have made us a much better team. And then, of course, after he left, a real goal-scoring centre-forward was the only bloody player we missed, because we then just had Giroud, who had been bought to be Van Persie's backup. Because that was the sum we bought, you know, Podolski and Cazorla. Yeah. And, you know, one can only... So that sort of adds to the pain of that situation. But rather than completely raking up old coals, the one reason why I will mention Cazorla just before we finish up is lots of rumours that we're going to get Dani Ceballos, the Real Madrid midfielder, on either a season on loan or possibly trying to buy outright, although it seems as though they're only prepared to sell him if they get an advantageous buyback clause. But the noises from Spain are that he's got a choice between Arsenal and Spurs, and he wants to come to Arsenal.
And, of course he does.
And, well, yes, indeed. And the certainly I can't think of many players who are within our grasp who have more potential in common to what they could bring to the team to Santi Cazorla, actually, in terms of being a central midfielder who can play as a 10 or in a central 2, but very skillful on the ball, good at retaining possession, good dribbler, good passer. I mean, you know, it'd be doing Real Madrid a favour, but it'd be sure as hell doing us a favour if we can get him for a year.
I have seen nothing of this guy, so to hear that is, obviously for me, it's quite exciting.
Well, obviously for you, Paul, yes.
Obviously for me, yeah. Just for me, no one else.
But, you know, he's a player that was a young superstar coming through at Real Betis. Wenger was sniffing around him, but quite understandably, he chose to go to Real Madrid ahead of Arsenal, which is, you know, probably fair enough when they can give him more money and more chance of winning the European Cup. As it happens, it hasn't really worked out for him in terms of getting game time at Madrid, and it seems like they want to keep him long term. And although sort of taking a player on loan from a bigger club seems to help with his development, seems sort of a slight ego wound for Arsenal, because we're the club that think we should be doing that. Given our current situation, I think it'd be an incredibly smart piece of business, because it allows us to keep the majority of our transfer budget still available to us whilst fulfilling a place where we do have a hole in the squad this year. And you never know, maybe Hector can get him to join the Geezer side and convince him that London should be his home. You never know. Anyway, that's just something I wanted to touch on. I think we'd better knock it on the head there, because we're past the hour mark and you've got to have dinner, and frankly, listeners have probably got things to do with their lives. Going ahead, looking where we are as a final thought, seeing where the squad is at the moment, apart from the obvious issues around central defence, what do you think the club should be targeting most as a signing? Just one position and one type of player.
I think it's got to be, I mean, they're doing it, but it's got to be the left back, hasn't it? I think.
Yeah, I'd actually agree. I would have probably at some stage, not so long ago, said the wide forward position, because we've managed to sell about six and not really buy any. But with the young players coming through and having young players coming through that do look like that long term, one or two of them may be able to significantly contribute in those areas. It does. Yeah, I'd agree that left back is the priority, given that Monreal certainly can't play a whole season anymore, and Kolasinac can't defend. So, okay, so we're all aboard the Kieran Tierney hype train. And on that note, just like to wish all you listeners a great week. Let's hope we beat Real Madrid in the season's last friendly in the States before we come back to Europe. And let's hope the kids give another good impression. And let's hope by the time we speak next, one or two players have been confirmed as joining the club, because that would take the edge off everything, wouldn't it? Anyway, thanks for listening to us getting this far. If you want to get in touch with us at Daily Cannon on Twitter, and have a lovely week. Thanks, Paul, for joining us.
Cheers.
And have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.